Welcome to Futures in Languages, a podcast showcasing stories from UCF's Modern Languages and Literatures Department alumni. I'm your host, Christina Torres, and today we'll be talking with Liliana Ramos, who graduated from the TEFL Certificate Program in 2023. She also majored in International and Global Studies and is now a Fulbright ETA in Logroño, Spain. We are so happy that you could take some time to chat with us today.
Yes, thank you. I'm so happy that you invited me onto your podcast.
It's always a treat to catch up with our students on the podcast. I know that you have a lot of stories to share with us about your very exciting year in Spain as an ETA. But before we get into that, I'm curious if you could just share with our listeners a little bit about yourself and maybe where you're from.
Of course. So I studied at UCF in 2019. I majored in International Global Studies and two minors in Intelligence and Asian Studies. And also TEFL, so my certificate. I am from Miami, so very Cuban-American. Both my parents are from Cuba, from La Habana. So I am a bilingual speaker, and I'm trying to learn a little bit of Korean. I like to paint. I have an artistic side. And yeah, I want to continue traveling.
Yeah. So was the travel what drew you to the TEFL certificate?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like it was my ticket in to maybe, because it's very different traveling and staying in a country. I wanted to experience staying in a country, like really seeing the intricacies of like what people do, right? Rather than like just travel and be there for a week. Mm-hmm. So I feel like TEFL was a good way for me to live and learn abroad.
Yeah. I think that was a big motivation for me too. Having traveled a bit in my undergrad, I realized, again, there was a very big difference between the tourist habits and the habits of folks who stay and engage in a local community. And the engagement in the local community is really what stood out as what I wanted to do. And it sounds like you had a similar feeling.
Yeah, definitely. Very much the same.
So how did you hear about the TEFL certificate at UCF?
I think it was, well, it's been a while, actually. I think it was through a friend. I think it was a friend that was doing TEFL because she wanted to go and participate in JET, which is the program to go to Japan to teach English. Mm-hmm. And she had told me about it. And she was like, listen, like, it's a great opportunity. Like, she spoke to me about it because I had spoken to her about how I also wanted to go to Japan and live there. So she was like, perfect. Like, let's do TEFL together. And the rest is history.
Yeah. And then you're in Spain, which is my next question, is what have you been up to since graduation? I know that you applied to a couple different programs and your result was Spain. Could you walk our listeners through a little bit of what that process was like?
Oh, God, that process was crazy. I think I drove everyone insane about it because I originally went to Fulbright. Like, I applied to Fulbright. That was my first choice. And I did it because in one of my TEFL classes, Morgan Bauer, he did a presentation about Fulbright. And I thought that was great. I was like, oh, okay, like, I'm going to apply. Like, it's pretty fitting. It's very academically prestigious. And also it would allow me to travel abroad. And then I got waitlisted. And then that kind of derailed me a little bit into like, oh, well, like, what's my other options? And then I applied to NALCAP, which is also the Ministry of Education here in Spain. And I applied to EON, which is to teach in Japan. And then so many things happened. I ended up getting out of the wait list. And then obviously I chose to go to Spain with Fulbright in November.
Okay, so you left in November, like right before the December holidays. And then when did the school year start for you in Spain?
Oh, September.
September, yeah. Okay.
They started in September. Since I was late, my whole visa process, that's why I ended up going in November.
Gotcha. So you came in then mid-year, if I understand you correctly.
Yes.
Okay, all right. School starts in September, but you arrived in November, and then here we are in the new year in 2024. So what have you been up to in Spain since arriving?
So a couple of things. Always traveling to a new country and choosing to live there. Immigrating is very difficult, but I've been working at primary school. So I work with 3 to 12-year-olds, so infantil to sixth grade. And I've been kind of working on that. I go to work every single day, except Fridays. And from Friday to Sunday, I've had some kind of some freedom to travel. So I've had the privilege of traveling to different parts of Spain. I've been to Asturias, Galicia, Valencia, Madrid, Barcelona. A lot of traveling, a lot of teaching. That I feel like is the two main things going on in Spain with me right now.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to the traveling point in just a second. But for folks who are curious about your day-to-day teaching, could you maybe walk us through what a quote, like, typical workday for you with your students could be?
Yeah, of course. So I start at 9 and I end at 2 p.m. And every single day I have a different rotation of classes. So, but it's the same every day. It's just they rotate differently. Mm-hmm. So, for example, today I had my 3 to 5 year olds. I had my first graders and I had my sixth graders. So I normally just show up to the class. I'm in a class for either 30 minutes to 1 hour. And I will start presentations normally with a hello, a greeting, and I will let the students know what I'm going to be doing with them. Some have been doing a project with me for a long time, so I don't have to like continue doing introductions. Mm-hmm. But mainly what I do on a teaching day is my own presentations. So I make them on PowerPoint, and it's whatever theme or topic the teachers want from me. So, for example, since St. Patrick's Day is coming up, they would ask me to do a presentation on St. Patrick's Day and to do activities with the kids. Mm-hmm. And they normally love it. This past week, I've been doing one on American culture. So I've been kind of going around different regions in the U.S. and showing them pictures and PowerPoint slides on like what the culture is in those areas. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's normally my everyday schedule. It's a rotation, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, presentations.
Okay.
And English.
And for folks who might be curious, how would your presentation maybe vary from the younger kids to your older students? Because you mentioned that you have a range of ages that you work with.
That was very difficult actually to deal with in the beginning because it was a lot of lesson planning. Because obviously what you show 3 to 5 year olds, you can't show a sixth grader. They will be very insulted. Actually, this one time I accidentally showed a sixth grader a presentation that I did for fifth grade, and I had it like as a subtitle, and they got upset. They were like, we're big boys. Like, we're the big girls. Like, we don't want to be learning something that's like a lower level. Mm. So for infantile, it's a lot of pictures, a lot of repetition, a lot of songs. You know, they have to be up and active because if you don't give them music, if you don't give them some time to shimmy, they will just lose focus. They will not pay attention to you. Mm-hmm. So a lot of QT stuff with my infantile kids, very simple. And then for my bigger kids, they do conversation hours a lot, or they like me to do conversation hour. They want me to talk with them and they want to talk back with me. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, since I'm in a small town here in Spain, unlike Madrid and Barcelona, where there's more foreigners, I'm their only native English speaker that they probably will ever get to know. Mm-hmm. So they want to practice with me. They want to be able to write with me, like write sentences, really practice how to use their English in their everyday life.
And it sounds like, given the range of ages, that they're starting to learn English very young in their school mm-hmm. process. So but I'm assuming, and feel free to correct me, I'm assuming that by the time you get them and they're older, they are ready to do the practice with you and eager to do the interactive conversations with you. Am I hearing that correctly?
Well, I've actually had a discussion with other Fulbrighters because while the eagerness is there, like they definitely want to do it, I feel like for how long they have been doing it for, their English maybe should be at a higher level, which obviously like, it ranges from student to student. Some students are very eager and they really care. Some students do get tutoring classes at home and that changes their level pretty differently. But I feel like in my school and maybe in Logroño, they implement a lot of Spanish instruction in the classes. So it kind of, for some students, forces them to not really want to force themselves to understand the English instruction. So I don't know. I don't really know. Sometimes I do struggle, like the sixth graders just struggle to have like a pretty basic conversation with me. And it does kind of like red alert me like, oh, like but you've been doing it for so long. But there's a lot of things going on, like, I guess, Logroño schools with teacher turnover and like different classes, you know, there's not consistency. So maybe that does impact their English education a little bit or their acquisition of the language.
Yeah, I would imagine that there are a lot of factors at play here to encourage the younger students to invest, right, in English, because we want them to invest in the language learning. And we learned from research and, you know, folks like, for example, Bonnie Norton, who does research and has done research on investment. It's not necessarily do I want to or do I not want to learn English, but it's like, do I enjoy, or am I invested in the class practices or the learning practices of it as well? That could be its own research study, is, you know, the investment mm-hmm. of students. We can say a lot about different factors that are influencing that. But it sounds like you have a very lively day and that there's a lot of variety in your day to day.
Yes.
Great.
Definitely.
You mentioned also that you're getting a chance to travel a bit around Spain. Could you share with our listeners a bit more about those experiences that you've been able to have now that you live in Spain? Mm-hmm.
So actually, my most recent travel has been to Asturias, because Fulbright does this thing called Mid-Year, where it does a conference with all of the Spanish ETAs, and they kind of get to look at presentations and talk about their experience in Spain. So I had the opportunity to go to Oviedo, and I got to try Sidra, which is a very popular, I think they're known for their cider, which is very delicious, and some very typical cuisines from the region. I got to see the mountains, the cows grazing, because I think that the best butter in Spain comes from Asturias because of the cows. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but that was a little fun fact that I learned. And tomorrow, I'm going to Aitona, which is in this small city in Catalonia called Lleida. And they're doing, because it's spring, obviously it's spring season, and the flowers are blossoming there. And they have these like, large rows of flower valleys that I really want to see. And yeah, I've been traveling pretty much from the north to south of Spain.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've got like cool plans most weekends. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Are you riding trains around to get places?
Yes. Yes. Transportation here is wonderful.
That is very good to know. You've talked us through your day-to-day. Could you share with our listeners a little bit more about your interactions with the community? Because we talked at the beginning about how our desire to really be connected to a community. Have you felt like you've been able to really find those connections in the local Logroño area as you've settled into Spain?
You know, I don't know if this is like, I feel like I'm just hanging out with Americans. And that is so upsetting. Why I'm in Spain, I should be with Spaniards, but I'm sticking by my Americans and I don't really know why. I mean, I know why. It's a comfort away from home. But I feel like the ETAs in Madrid and Barcelona, in bigger cities, have maybe a better chance of including themselves into more Spaniard-centered communities rather than like here in Logroño, where it's a very like small town, a very small city. So people kind of stick by what they know. Mm-hmm. Like a lot here, they've been friends with people since elementary. They don't really see much room in their community to include, I guess, outsiders or foreigners, which I completely understand. You know, it's not really anything that upsets me, which is also part of the reason why I keep sticking by Americans, because I don't feel that easiness to include myself in Spanish communities, so I just kind of go to what I know. Mm. But Fulbright does this thing for like side projects, which the whole purpose of a side project is to force Fulbrighters to really become one with their community. And my side project is going around doing street interviews where I ask people about their clothing inspiration. So obviously, because Logroño is a very small city, most people do kind of, I guess, dress very similarly. But you have those few people that do dress like very, I guess, outlandishly for like Logroño standards. And I kind of stop them in the street. I'm like, hey, like, I would love to learn like what influences you, like why you like wearing your clothes, or, like what style inspo you look into. And it's been like, that's been one of the most like effective ways of me becoming one with the Logroño community. It's like those little street interviews where I get to ask them and kind of be interested in why they're dressing the way they do. Because I love fashion. Fashion is a great way to express yourself.
Mm-hmm. I'm a fan also. Yeah, I would love to get a chance to do more fashion type things in the future. But what is, out of curiosity, what is the goal of the collection of these interviews? Are you putting them together for some kind of project? Is it something that you report back on your Fulbright? I know there's always a report at the end of our Fulbright time, right?
Yeah, so it's definitely a report.
Yeah. I'm curious if you're reporting on it. Yeah.
I'm going to be putting them in a blog. And then I'll be like putting it in my blog, and I'll have like a little subsection where I include what they talked about. And then I'll put pictures and I'm like collecting. I'm in the collection stage. I'm not really in the blogging stage yet. Mm-hmm. But once I'm done with the blog and I have it published, then I do report it back to Fulbright, because that is technically my side project. Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's the same for the ETAs, but when I was an English language fellow, we would have to send these, gosh, what did they call them? Event reports? Like anytime you did something, so they could put them in their news blurbs also on the web pages and things. Do they do that with the ETAs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much if any ETA does anything, they're like, please send us pictures. Please let us know.
Yeah. I remember doing events over in Bangladesh, and the sign-in sheet would include the section of I'm okay with my picture being, and by signing in, I'm okay with my picture being sent for these things. And we would try not to get faces as much, like we try to get the backs of folks' heads and focus on the front of the room or whatever, but getting documentation of that was part of the process as well.
Definitely.
So you've shared with us your stories about living in Logroño and traveling around Spain. Is there a standout, maybe like a story that you'd like to share with our listeners who might be curious about, maybe they're considering the ETA ship in Europe, let's say, maybe Spain or maybe not. Is there a story that you think would be one you'd like to share with folks as an inspirational moment?
Yeah, of course. Is this like inspirational about Fulbright specifically or just the act of teaching abroad?
It could be either way, or the act of teaching abroad could be good there too.
Well, in general, both for Fulbright and for teaching abroad, I think that it's such a wonderful feeling of impacting a community that's so far away from where you live, you know, because obviously English opens so many doors for people. Like I do clases particulares, which is like tutoring gigs, where I go to people's houses and I help their children with English. And actually one of the girls that I'm tutoring, not necessarily because of me, like she was phenomenal even before I was tutoring her, but because of this consistent act of like English, she was able to participate in a cultural exchange program where she was able to go to Germany and kind of live there for a week. And then the girl that she was with in Germany gets to go to Spain and they get to learn from each other's countries. And the biggest eligibility for that program is to know English, right? Because both of these people aren't speaking Spanish or German, they're speaking English to each other. So I think that that's just such a wonderful feeling, right? Like if you want to have an impact on a community, I feel like English teaching is such an amazing gig, right? And specifically in Europe, I will say it is so affordable and fast to travel from European country to European country. Just in my couple months that I've been living in Spain, I've gone to Sweden, England, different parts of Spain, and I'm going to Italy now. And it's been so affordable, like crazy. Like obviously when you're an American, you have to like cross over the big ocean every single time you want to go to Europe. So being able to teach in English in Europe has been great because of the accessibility and learning about other countries.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's a really great learning experience in all facets. And that leads me to my next question, which is, I know you did our TEFL certificate. What lessons from the TEFL certificate do you think about now? In other words, how did the program prepare you for your life now?
Well, definitely the volunteer conversation hours that we did, actually with your class, were phenomenal. I actually look at my reflections every once in a while to really see how it would be implemented with my students or how the students would feel about it or how I would feel about that specific lesson. So conversation hour has been great. Grammar lessons. So obviously when you're a native speaker, you don't really think about the questions that someone that's learning English might have, right? Like I remember I had one of my students, they were very young, asked me why I needed to put a S to identify plurality, like when a word is plural. And obviously for me, it's just like, we'll just put an S. Like, but it's like they want to really understand the process. And in order to really break down English teaching, you have to understand how their minds work, right? Like, because obviously, like as a native speaker, you forget about these rules. You forget about these like nitty gritty lessons that I feel like the TEFL book has really helped me and how to be able to answer that question. And let's see. There's just so many great things that TEFL really gave me, honestly. I really feel like I wouldn't be able to do this without a TEFL certification because teaching English is so different to just being a native speaker. You really have to understand the student and what the learner needs.
And, so, and folks, you heard it from Liliana. You didn't hear it from me. She just said it, that you got to have training to teach English.
Yeah.
And I think you're reflecting on something that I really tried to emphasize in the classes in the TEFL certificate, is that being a fluent or native speaker is a wonderful start, but it's not in and of itself a teaching qualification. And a lot of these subconscious things that we do as native speakers of any language need to be brought to the surface. If you're going to be teaching the language, we have to have the meta language. Whether or not we use it with our students obviously has to do with their needs and what it is that you're doing, etc. But we as teachers need to know the nitty-gritty. So you can answer those questions like, hey, why is that S? Or what is that S? Because, you know, the S can be a lot of different things. We can be talking about subject-verb agreement. We can be talking about plurality. We can do a lot of things with that morpheme there. So that kind of knowledge, I hear, has been helpful to you. And that's encouraging. Mm-hmm. That's good to know.
Definitely.
So we have a segment, Liana, called Ask Our Alumni. Are you ready for a question from our correspondent, Miley?
Yes, of course.
So here we go.
In immersing yourself in a language, did you do this mainly through speaking or reading? And which texts or communities did you most often engage with?
Okay, well, thank you so much, Miley. I'll answer the first part. I will ask for the second part again.
Sure.
A way that I've immersed myself into the language, which I am a native speaker, so I already knew Spanish when I came over to Spain. I didn't need to learn it. But what has made me kind of help really practice and perfect my Spanish has been reading. I think that reading, specifically Spanish books, here in Spain, because there's not that many. I mean, I don't know, maybe in Madrid and Barcelona is different. But here in Logroño, finding an English book is impossible. You will not find it. So it's kind of forced me to read Spanish books. Currently, I'm reading a translation of, I think it's called The Cries of Catalunya by George Orwell, but it's like not in English, it's in Spanish. So I'm able to like understand like the Spanish Civil War and the history around that time and Catalonia as a whole. And it's made me really feel more connected with the country. When you learn about its history, you learn about its people and what it's been through. And so that's been a way of immersing myself into the culture through the language. I kind of already mentioned the text, which is books, right? Mm-hmm. A variety of books here in Spain, in bookstores. And communities, well, I guess speaking, you know, when you go to a restaurant, you go to a coffee shop, when speaking even to my other teachers in my school that aren't English teachers, that's been a way of me immersing myself with them and speaking with them and practicing my Spanish.
Sounds good. And also you mentioned like engaging in, we know that there are regional variations to Spanish, right? Like my Puerto Rican Spanish and your Cuban heritage Spanish and our Florida Spanish compares to Spanish in Logroño. What are some comparisons that you've made as out of curiosity while you've been there?
They really do clock you. Like they know when you're not a Spaniard, right? You can walk in with your perfect Spanish and they're like, oh, are you from the Caribbean? And I'm like, how did you know that? But they always know that I'm Cuban or Puerto Rican. That's always what they ask. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I guess they catch on to it is definitely the accent, but also certain words. Spaniards really have their own regional slang. I have definitely noticed that, and it can really go over my head most of the time. But more, I guess, non-slang related conversation has been coche. So they don't say carro, they just say coche. Mm-hmm. That I've not gotten used to at all. So whenever I say carro, they automatically know. It clicks in their heads. That is not a Spaniard.
Mm-hmm. And in my mind, coche just means like carriage, right? Like for us, like it's a but I hear you. I hear you. Yeah. Well, that's good for folks to hear. Again, we want to show like even when you do know a language, you move to a place that speaks it and there are regional varieties that we then adjust to. All right, Liliana, I have one more question for you here in your episode, and that is, what advice would you offer someone who is interested in studying TEFL?
Okay. Advice for teaching or for learning how to gain a TEFL certificate. What advice would I give to you? Definitely to be open, because I feel like kind of how we were talking in the beginning about how you just assume that because you're a native English speaker that it would just come naturally to you. And it definitely is a learning curve. And you're teaching the language, so there's going to be that intricacies that you might have not known of before. So definitely being open with yourself and being patient, not jumping to conclusions about like what would be the best way to teach English, but like looking into the research, looking into the techniques that have already been peer-reviewed, right? That's effective. And to practice, I feel like the volunteer hours at the UCF Global really helped me a lot during the TEFL certificate because I was able to apply when I was learning, which is always a benefit, specifically on such a face-to-face career like teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the goals that we have with those conversation hours is for those of us who are training to be able to moderate our level of complexity, because being able to speak at level one English is different than being able to speak at intermediate or at advanced levels, right? If we're thinking about being a teacher, we have to be able to dial up and dial down the complexity of the input that we give to our students. So I appreciate you mentioning that exercise is helpful, because once we bring up all of the metalinguistic awareness of the English language, putting it into practice of how much do I do and how exactly, how complicated will my conversation be, is tricky, right? It takes some practice to get to that comfort level of you're an intermediate. These are the vocabulary words I'm going to use, and these are the verb tenses that I'm comfortable using, and I'm going to watch how I use certain things to make sure that you understand, and then push it a little bit to see and make sure that we are growing and learning, right? Again, Liliana, I know that you have plenty going on. You have a lot to do over there in your ETA ship, and we appreciate you taking some time out to come chat with us. Is there any final thought that you'd like to end your episode on?
I guess that if you're thinking of doing it, I definitely push you to do it. I think it's been such an amazing opportunity. Definitely the beginning was a little bit scary. I mean, it always is scary to like get out of your comfort zone and move to a new country and start over. But I think that the person I've become now has been so vastly different to the person I was at UCF or back home, that if you are thinking of doing TEFL or if you are thinking of teaching abroad, to definitely take the initiative, because I think it could be very life-changing.
Awesome. Thank you, Lillian. Thank you for listening to this episode of Futures in Languages. I'd like to give a shout-out to DaVideo Guy for our intro and outro music downloaded from freesound.org. I'm Christina Torres, and our featured guest today was Liliana Ramos. Tune in next time to hear more alumni stories from Modern Languages. For more information about the TEFL certificate and other language programs in the Modern Languages Department, please visit our website at cah.ucf.edu/languages.